Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We will open the meeting with a reading of the Declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles. Through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In an effort to carry out the policy of this lodge, the local branch has a program consisting of several activities. Each Sunday from 11 until 12 noon, there is a talk, forum, or panel presented, followed by a period for questions and discussion. The general theme for the month of February is Life Problems and Theosophical Solutions. Now, the last talk in the month will be presented today, and it is entitled Fear and Doubt. Next Sunday morning, which will be March 6th, there will be a talk entitled From Belief to Faith and Knowledge. And the theme for next month is the development of mind. Now, on Sunday mornings, of course, from 11 until 12 noon is when this Sunday morning meeting is held. Now, on Wednesday, March 2nd, the class is engaged in a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. The class is now taking up the subject of karma, that universal law of cause and effect. This coming Wednesday, it will be viewed from the standpoint of the three fields of karma. On the 18th of the month, there is a class dedicated to the study or the comparative study of religion and philosophies. The subject for the 18th is Patanjali's Yoga Operism. These classes begin at 7 o'clock and last for 1 hour. The doors of the lodge are open at 6:30. Now on Sunday, March 20th, there will be a special meeting commemorating the life and work of William Q. Judge, who was one of the co-founders of the Theosophical movement back in 1875. The general lecture on that Sunday is entitled,
Philosopher, Guide, Friend.
Okay, Philosopher, Guide, and Friend. Now, this lodge maintains a reference library, which is open each Wednesday from 5:30 to 7:30. It carries a straight line of theosophical literature, consisting of books, pamphlets, and magazines. During library hours, there is always assistance available. Also, this same literature may be purchased just outside of this room. It is on sale and can be purchased during the regular weekly meetings or before or after our regular meetings. Now, all activities of this lodge are free. The lodge continues to be sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. And all are most welcome to participate. The reading for today has been selected from The Voice of the Silence, pages 57 to 59. Armed with the key of charity, of love and tender mercy, thou art secure before the gate of Dana, the gate that standeth at the entrance of the path. Behold, O happy pilgrim, the portal that faces thee is high and wide, seems easy of access. The road that leads therethrough is straight and smooth and green. 'Tis like a sunny glade in the dark forest depths, a spot on earth mirrored from Amitabha's paradise. There nightingales of hope and birds of radiant plumage sang perched in green boughs, chanting access to fearless pilgrims. They sang of Bodhisattva's virtues five, the fivefold source of Bodhi power, and of the seven steps in knowledge. Pass on, for thou hast brought the key. Thou art secure. And through the second gate, the way is verdant too. But it is steep and winds uphill, yea, to its rocky top. Gray mists will overhang its rough and stony length and be dark beyond. As on he goes, the song of hope soundeth more feeble in the pilgrim's heart. The thrill of doubt is now upon him. His step less steady grows. Beware of this, O candidate. Beware of fear that spreadeth like the black and soundless wings of midnight bat. Between the moonlight of thy soul and the great goal that loometh in the distance far away. Fear, O disciple, kills the will and stays all action. If lacking in the shield of virtue, the pilgrim trips and karmic pebbles bruise his feet along the rocky path. Be of sure fear, O candidate, and Shanta's essence bathe thy soul. For now thou hast approached the polar of that name, the gate of fortitude and patience. Close not thine eyes, nor lose thy sight of Georgie. Maris arrows ever smite the man who has never reached Virago. Beware of trembling, neath the breath of fear. The key of Shanti rusty grows, the rusty key refuses to unlock. The subject of the talk is fear and doubt.
Good morning. We are at the end of a month's consideration of life problems and theosophical solutions. And what has been saved for last, truly, doubt and fear, is an interesting subject. And our title, Doubt and Fear Block Progress, probably sums up human nature at this point in time. So we're dealing with that last but most potent of emotions, and it is said from the scientific side of life that this is the most primal, the oldest of emotions. And certainly it's a potent emotion, fear and its twin doubt, capable of doing damage when we allow it to be so. And therein lies the solution from a theosophical point of view, a blend of religion and philosophy and science, enabling us to look at life's problems and then creatively find and pursue solutions to those problems. Now, if fear is said to be a primal emotion, a very, very old emotion, and we can observe it in great nature, and we know that when fear is used in harmony with nature, we can make sense of what we're observing about fear. Seen in the animal kingdom, fear is instinct, isn't it? In the animal, we can observe a very rapid reflex situation where the animal senses a threat to survival, reacts, and does one of three things. Fear presents a blockage in some ways, and in others, a release. The animal can fight, it can flee, and in still other cases, might freeze entirely. So where there's action, where there is a fight or a fleeing, there's a chance for physical survival. If that animal freezes in fear, then we see the demise of the little animal. In a similar way, we can see the function of fear in a very pure primal form in the human infant. The infant is certainly the closest form that we use as soul. It's the closest to the homogeneity, if you will, of the absolute or the deific. And within the human infant, we see again the role of instinct. We know that the full application of mind has not kicked in. There's no self-consciousness in the newborn infant. But there is an instinct to survive. The newborn infant that is confidently rooting to find nourishment will move slowly and gradually and follow its sense of smell to a source of food. But the infant that senses that it could be dropped suddenly startles and grabs and clutches and holds on with a closed, tight fist. Again, that's a very animal-like response, because certainly as soul we're using primate forms, we're using animal kinds of forms to connect with our environment. So we know that the fear of being dropped, that fear of not being able to survive, is instinctive. It's at the natural base animal form that we're all using, and that fear of loss of oneness, loss of security, is very pure at birth. We also, if we're able to observe very young toddlers, those that are just about cruising around 12 months old, we know they go through a time period of acting strange, that there's a fear that kicks in around 12 months old, where there's a dawning recognition that the infant is no longer at one with its primary caregiver, that primary caregiver looks uniquely different from stranger. And the stranger is fearsome. And the child around 12 months old begins to react with fear. Are you going to get me? Are you with me? Are you like the caretaker? You know, what's going on here? And we know again that is a process, an evolution, if you will, an unfoldment that within that human infant is the beginning of soul stirrings and a beginning of a process of self-identification, but we're still seeing an instinctive reaction to the environment and fear of the unknown, fear of the strange, fear of the other, because it's a threat to survival. There's a lot of research being done right now with the amygdala in the brain being what appears to be the fear center. But we know, frankly, that in those cases of the animal and the infant, we know that nature unaided fails. If that animal or that infant freezes on that kind of instinctive fear, if that becomes more and more complicated in life, then there is no growth. There is no progress. The baby that's clutching with closed fists as a newborn, that presentation in the adult is still clutching in fear, about to run away and flee, or is about to fight, but the fists are closed. There's no availability for openness, for help, for assistance, for giving. And therefore, in the gradually awakening adult form, there is a block of progress. And we know that fear in potential can have many different forms, and certainly our popular literature today does a bang-up job of covering post-traumatic stress syndrome or panic attacks, people that have anxiety to the point of obsessive-compulsive disorders. And frankly, in each of those scenarios, if we use something like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where there's an instinctive need for security and survival, for shelter and food and nourishment of the heart, affiliation, if you will, that each of those things karmically come to us in the environment. And as we proceed away from that baseline of animalistic natural fear progression, as we grow through life karmically and we gain different experiences, that form of the brain that we're using, that amygdala, can change function. And it can go from a natural progression where the stimulus of the outside environment is sensed, the message goes up into the cortex, the thinking portion of the brain, and then is then communicated to all the hormonal responses in the physical body that express fear. Or in the case of a lot of these conditions that might be traumatic, or in the case of a tradition where a child is raised to remain fearful, is raised to remain at that instinctive level of fearing the unknown, of being ready to flee from something that's new or that's considered other or strange. The child that's been traumatized in some way carries that very natural response into adult humanhood and shortcuts the cortex. There's research now that amygdala takes on a response of its own, and there's a very rapid-fire reaction without any thought, without any time period, where our parents may have said, well, count from 1 to 10. You know, give the gap between your fear, your anger, that emotion. And then in that 1 to 10, think about it and then respond. When that's destroyed, when soul or mind, however you want to consider that, does not remain in control of the physical instrumentation, then we get these other responses that we allow. In the human, unlike human adult, unlike the child, the infant, the animal, there is free will and choice. We do have the potential to reason with intellect from a premise to a conclusion. We can, as mind beings, use that physical brain to slow down that process of instinct and transmute it into intuition. We're not just of the animal kingdom, but we certainly are a dual. And so as we move through life and we see certain vicious cycles, like there'll be doubt, self-doubt. I don't know if I can do that. Then fear might set in, if you will. Or maybe we're grieving a loss and there is a grief, fear, doubt kind of cycle that we see operating. We can see our behaviors, we can see our emotions, and we observe that all that's going on. We can begin to logic for ourselves that we're in a pattern of self-fulfilling prophecy, that with the limitations of grief and fear and doubt, we can create illnesses for ourselves, mental illnesses, physical illnesses. And we can do harm to everything around us if we allow these blocks of fear and doubt to be more than triggers, but actually to be a controlling mechanism in our lives. So what is it with fear and doubt? If we reason from premises that if we lead our lives from the basis of fear, what we're choosing to do as soul is to think about the physical body as being the wherewithal, the whole caboodle, if you will. And those of us that live from fear are actually focused, using all their powers of thought and comprehension and all the energies that we can imagine, but they're focusing them in the physical form and the incarnation of that personality. And if we could get them to think about it a little bit, then they would begin to say, wait a minute, are we operating on the same instinct to survive, but we're applying it to a physical form that by nature has to decay? It has to begin to weaken and relinquish. And it changes over time. The sense of I am, and that identity that we develop and we come into around 7 years old or so, where we are knowing that we are self-fulfilling individuals, if we handicap that identification process and create this, I am the body, I'm only the brain, I only live once, I better protect the survival of that little entity, or worse, I'm a lowly sinner, I'm stained with original sin, if you will, any kind of limitation to the human entity, that is the root of all this doubt and fear. It's, in essence, a lack of understanding of spiritual premises. For those who can live from a viewpoint not of fear and doubt, but live from a viewpoint of hope, and love and openness and kindness, if you will, there is no immediate instinctual, I'm going to flee from this situation. Rather, there is a rational basis for fear and doubt. And fear and doubt become instruments for growth. They become instruments that can be used. Yes, there certainly is, all of us should fear fire. There are things that truly are dangerous and that on the basis of rationality need to be feared because it's common sense. To ignore danger would certainly be irrational in certain situations. But what we call common sense and theosophy might also be called intuition by some or direct perception by someone else. It is a reflection of the divine wisdom of the soul. It's a reflection of an identity process that's not with a particular body. It's not with a particular incarnation. It is not based on the particular, but rather it's an expression, an intuition, a oneness, if you will, with the cosmic, with the universal, with the composite. So whereas the fearful entity worried about survival of just the physical form is going to constrict and narrow and literally go into a fetal position with withdrawn hands and fists, that entity, that thinking individual who says, okay, rationally speaking, there are things to fear. There are certain dangers in life. And each morning after a deep sleep, I still know that I am. The amnesiac who's lost function of the brain and the body for a while may not know the particulars of their life, but they haven't ceased to exist. They are spiritually still in the same I am, I perceive, I can sense differences. They're in the same frame of reference. So what's the theosophical solution for this whole thing? Well, how do we deal with little kids who are in the middle of a night terror, who are panicked out of their minds? And we literally say out of their minds, don't we? They're fearful, and then they generalize that particular night terror to fear of the dark. Well, we know that when someone's in a truly panicked scenario, they're out of their minds, they're lost in the animal or the instinctive lower nature, it's not a good time to be logical. It's not a real good time to try to speak from the heart with wisdom, because they're out of their minds. They're not open to perceiving. So what do we do with a little child? Well, we gradually, as caretakers, lead the little child through a series of things. In daylight, explore the corners of the bedroom or the closet or whatever seems to be scary. At twilight, as the lights begin to dim, play games with flashlights and tiny toys that might glow. And gradually give the child enough experience to know that they can control a light, that as thinkers they can look around and be reasonable in the light time. Then when the fear comes back, as emotions do, that comes back in cycles, the child has some experience to draw from, has a sense of confidence that they can control situations with the light, and very gradually then begin to enjoy, say, shadow play with hand puppets and whatnot. And that's the same procedure that's based on theosophic wisdom across the ages, if you will. In terms of divine wisdom, in terms of what we call soul knowledge, or the heritage of many, many cultures and many ages and philosophy, religion, legends, glyphs, and even science drawn into it, within our heart of hearts, we have an intuitive basis that we know that we exist, that given the hardship of a particular great trauma or minor fear, we can begin to build a new experience and explore around the edges of the fear. We can begin to think through solutions, like the child playing with a flashlight in the dark, like the child who gets brave enough to go out into the backyard and enjoy fireflies and stars. We can begin to look at what's strange and what at first seems to be challenging, gradually move through it in new experiences with new tools, and on the basis of those new tools and new experiences, begin to grow, if you will, and begin to be freed to use our will, to use choice, to develop action, to be creative, and to approach life not with closed fists ready to fight or fly, but rather to approach life with open hands, with a compassionate oneness with the law of karma, if you will, a compassionate oneness of living for the good of all. And so what would the theosophical opposition to the tamasic, the Indian culture has a word, tamas, in action, in inertia, a slovenliness of spiritual application, if you will. And those tamasic snares, those spiritual snares, the same way physically the baby clutches and freezes, a human adult can begin to freeze up in their use of will, in their use of power, in their ability to think logically and react creatively. And what are some of those fears that are so very common? Well, most of us, it turns out, fear authority. And certainly what if we consider blind obedience to an external authority, perhaps that's a rational fear. Many of us fear public opinion, and it presents as fear of public speaking. being accepted. And many of us take that to a tremendous end and make it a lot more complicated than it is. Because after all, you deliver a talk and it's over in 10 minutes, thank goodness. Others of us have a fear of risking belief systems. Once we've been inculcated with a particular system of thought, we fear leaving the flock, leaving the congregation, or we might fear stepping over into another culture. And again, isn't that a misinterpretation of survival? I'm comfortable where I am here with this caregiving, nurturing environment. I've been accepted here. But if I step out of it, am I going to be stoned to death and not survive? Or am I going to be shunned? And again, we go back to those Maslow hierarchy of needs. And so many of us have a dread of sacrifice. We fear risking comfort. We know what's comfortable, but stretching into a new zone of exploration is not so cool. If you stop and think about it, you can watch epidemics of fear moving through a population. What happens with the stock market when there's a tremendous loss of confidence or panic? We even call it a panic. The stocks go down because the value has changed for the business or the service. No, it's the way we perceive it. We have false evidence appearing real. And once that false evidence appears real, we then have a mass epidemic, if you will, of many souls blindly going like a herd and developing a course of action that's not too cool. There's a wonderful quote by Eleanor Roosevelt. You gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You sense fear, you do the counting to 10, as we were taught as children, and really look it in the face and think about it. What happens then is you bring your mind and your heart together. She went on to say, you are able to say to yourself, I have lived through this horror. I can take the next thing that comes along. You must do the thing you think that you cannot do. So spiritual culture, force is gained through concentration. There's one solution that we've got. And then after the concentration and the thinking, acting from the basis of the heart and the mind, we can undo the natural snares, if you will, of fear and doubt. There are many different sources. You can go into the text of the Bible. You can go into the text of the Bhagavad Gita. And in most cases, you will find out that among all spiritual traits, and certainly for the Maslow self-actualizing adult, the first trait of many is often fearlessness, an openness to be a determination that the environment is to be explored, that there's a quality of steadfastness and confidence or faith of belief in one's own reliance, that we can, on the basis of our own intuition, judge whether or not we want to follow an outside authority, judge whether or not a situation is as fearsome as we first saw, and then figure out how to conquer the fear of the unknown. We can begin to use our soul powers to understand that in relationships, when someone else presents as tremendously angry, that's actually fear. Right behind the anger stands fear. And if we can gradually talk to the fearful place and lead the other to a calm, observant, rational point of view, just a calm place where we can share information, that gradually that faith, that self-confidence in I can think, I am, I can be, I am greater than all this illusion of daily life, arouses our will and our intuition. And that as mind beings, we don't have to use our physical brains with that funny little amygdala sparking and sending all these little messages to other brain areas and to the adrenaline system. We can progress to a state of being soul beings, using our instrumentation and doing no harm. Moving to a situation where we can fear no failure, court no success, but just remain philosophical, centered, sweet servants of great nature. Now, I'm sure you came to these rooms with observations of your own on the subject, way, way back in the corner.
We would think, though, that karma could play a huge part in one's ability to overcome the fear and doubt of, you know, the terms that we talk about, you know, blocked by karma. So could we, you know, speak to that for a minute?
Sure. One of the tenets, there are three basic tenets in the philosophy, for those of you who are newcomers this morning. One of the propositions that we consider and try to evaluate is, are all human beings, in fact, is everything in manifestation from the same universal source? Is there a oneness to life? And a second proposition that is tested out, discussed, and debated is there a universal law of periodicity? In other words, cause and effect, or action and reaction? And does in the human kingdom, does that law of karma or cause and effect, does that balancing process actually move across many incarnations? Is there reincarnation? And the third proposition that we consider is that as soul entities, are we here to ethically impress all manifestations of that oneness, to uplift all manifestations of that oneness? Well, if for a moment we accept the proposition that there is karma in reincarnation, then on the basis of past lives, just like in this particular incarnation, on the basis of my past years of living and experience, I have developed tools or I've developed traps with which I deal with new causes and new circumstances. So if there are cause and effect that we can see in daily life, across incarnations, causes set up in the past come to fruition as effects in this life. There may be many souls who are karmically using brains that are the result of past actions. It may be that one soul is using a brain where that amygdala, that fear center, is so overly developed that that soul is experiencing instrumentation that is more apt to be phobic. Maybe their physical makeup and their neurological makeup is more apt to go into panic attacks, while another soul is experiencing life. Some of the most recent research has been done with a woman who had a brain injury from a stroke. The amygdala literally was damaged completely and no longer functions. She has no fear at all. Doesn't get that you shouldn't walk out in front of a racing car on a street. Would probably try to cuddle a lioness protecting her cub. There's no fear at all. And so extreme is this that particular woman doesn't recognize the look of fear on somebody else's face. She's lost the ability in that physical brain for that soul to judge rational fear, correct fear. So by karmic law, there's certainly cases where there's been a body born to express in a particular way, by karma, we come into a particular household where the parents may operate on the basis of fear. You know, don't we as Americans, as a composite, remember a political phrase, speak softly and carry a big stick? You know, culturally, we come into large groups. So again, it is by karma. And having said that, as soul, we are greater than the karma. We are the creators of the karma. So even if we're in a scenario where the base living on the basis of fear is familiar, or a new circumstance rightly endows us with some fearfulness or anxiety, then we philosophically smile and just act as if. You know, small kids say, oh, I've got the ziffs today. In other words, I'm afraid of this test, but I'm going to act as if I'm not. And in that way, we begin to build the muscles, control the brain function, and set new causes up for other karma in the future. Yeah.
So said a little differently, we heard in the Eleanor Roosevelt quote, the thing we think we are unable to do. And we were thinking that relates more to doubt, that we doubt we are unable to make this happen. And we love the Gibran quote, doubt is a pain too lonely to know that faith is his twin brother. So we were thinking, then what do we put our faith in? Well, it was said earlier, I am. And if that is true, then I am able. And it is taking that spiritual position, that soul position, that will allow us to overcome whatever that difficulty is at the moment. It's getting to that that's often the hard
It's
part.
Getting to that. And doubt is a tremendous tool when used correctly. Think about the Middle Ages. During the medieval time in Europe, there were entities, political and religious, social entities, that controlled the population. And fear, we would call it superstition now, governed completely. There was this incredible control over mind in Europe, over the creativity of the human spirit. People walked in lockstep, and boy, that's it. Whatever the external authority said, that was it. Comes along doubt in the Middle Ages. And a few self-confident individuals, probably following the Gibran path, if you will, begin to doubt the validity of the external authorities. And what's the bloom of the medieval doubt, which gradually becomes confidence, gradually becomes inquisitiveness, gradually becomes rebellion, literally, but the Renaissance. So if we premise that we are soul entities, mind, using incarnation, using the forms at our avail, the lower nature, to contact the environment and move beyond, if we quiet those instruments that we've got at our avail and listen to the internal, and when a doubt comes up, think about it, weigh it, look into it, consider it, and have the confidence perhaps to move on the doubt, to move through the fear that might result, looking for compassion and ethics and purity and living for service to others. We can use the baseline of our own conscience to move beyond and to use these as tools with which to create new harmony with the whole. Yeah.
We wonder if what was just mentioned about the Middle East, if we don't see that cycle recurring.
Medieval Europe.
We wonder if we don't see that cycle recurring again in the Middle East right now, against the theocracies and the tyrants that these people are living in lockstep under.
It's a an interesting proposition. And don't we have childhood stories where the emperor has no clothes? You know, we're taught where an entire population, oh, the emperor looks beautiful. Yeah, sure, he's naked. You know, but if everybody agrees to, from fear, to follow certain propositions and the external authority, things swing around. The irony is during the medieval times, what helped to free Europe were the Middle Easterners and the North Africans, who brought to Europe all of the wisdom of the ages from Asia, Middle East, North Africa, and helped to free the European continent. So it will be very interesting to be alive in this time period. Our heart is with the suffering, of course, but our task at a distance is to observe and say, hey, is there a pattern here? Is it time now for Europe to give back and to help and assist? Or is it like the little chick who has to rip its way out of its own egg to survive? Should we be very careful about when we mess with somebody else's self-determination? Yeah.
We find these words very helpful. And the idea of universal brotherhood sort of shines in these words. But as we sit here in this very moment, you're separate from me. You're over there, and you're separate. And then if we dwell on that, we wonder, well, is my neighbor really my brother? Is he going to look out for me, or is he going to do this? And doubt. And it's this idea of separateness that drives us away from each other and presents that doubt of who we are. How do each of us find that person that witnesses these events of the day? And is it important to find that person or that power in us?
You know, a lot of that question is an echo, isn't it, of the 12-month-old who is just beginning to observe, I can move on my own and I can walk over here, but if I walk over here, mom and dad are over there. And uh-oh, if they're over there, here comes this stranger between where I am and where they are. And so a lot of that we're separate is rooted in that early animal instinct kind of observation. And the antidote for that theosophically is a period of what we've been advised in Christian traditions and in Islam and certainly in Buddhism and Hinduism is to pray within the closet of one's heart. In other words, in a period of meditation, or better, in that early morning time period when we're just aroused from deep sleep, make an effort to consider the waking process. You know, falling asleep, it goes by and we don't know when that's happening. But in the morning when we're awakening, there is a sense of existence that, you know, just gradually there's a change in light, or maybe we're aware of sound in the room. And then very, very gradually we come to an aspect of I'm awake, that's a little more of an arousal. And then we begin to take on the trappings of the day. Who am I? What am I doing? Oh gosh, I'm late. I got to hurry up. I've got this task and that task. The personality comes in last. Well, in that very early arousal of existence, that is a state in which we are all one. If we close our eyes and in that meditative darkness, I am, we're all thinking, I am that, we are all one in that. There's no differential at all. And then if we begin to think about it a little bit more, in in the aftermath of 9/11, with New Yorkers running down the streets or helping each other out of debris, there was no class, there was no caste, there was no sex, there was no race, there was no condition. It was we. And in fact, the entire nation and pretty much the whole world stopped for a while, laid down all the illusions of all the glamorous aspects of being alive in a physical form, and were transfixed on that sense of we and that pure aspiration to help and assist because we are. It's in those moments of contemplation, whether we plan a period in the morning to think about spiritual realities and what it might be to live as a divine entity, or when we have episodic events in life where something horrific happens and we watch everyone rush together to help and save the other with no observation of you're there and I'm here, but it's we, that force of altruism that comes from the spiritual center of a human being is remarkable. And the other consideration is that that kind of episodic event can become a methodical, meditative stance, a concerted effort across the days of our lives, if we allow it to be, if we will it to be, if we create it to be. We know that just as an infant who's making strange at 12 months old is the same soul using a slightly bigger body at 2 and 3 years old, where there's no consideration of any differences among children in a sandbox or a playground. They'll do parallel play. They have a sense of justice. Don't snatch that toy off me, I'll snatch it right back. But they don't see differences of race, condition, sex. They see another small person, like they're parched in the desert, looking for companionship. They identify with, oh, there's another baby. There's a oneness there. They grow into that if they're allowed to. And they sustain that feeling if they're allowed to and are not carefully taught to hate. They sustain that feeling throughout life and gradually enlarge that circle of trusted others, or we, through to the point as adults, we can imagine what the universe would be like with a totally harmonious humankind moving from the basis of love and compassion and sharing on behalf of all. That was too Indian, too long, but that's the reaction to what you said. Yeah.
Interesting you used the word love, because we were thinking as a correspondence, when we're peeling something, a vegetable or something, or going through layers, we always say we want to get to the heart of it. So what was described was a peeling away process, or shaving away of what we can identify as illusory and transient, to the heart of it, or what sustains all.
Yeah, and we can do that in a meditative stance. Whether it's in a planned period where we're quietly sitting to pray and meditate, you know, at the beginning of the day, the end of the day, or we're riding the bus in the beginning, we can go through that exercise of shaving. I am not someone's child or their parent or an aunt or an uncle or a sibling, or, you know, I'm not really an employee. I am a composite entity acting on the basis of experience, expressing experience and wisdom, however limited, as best as can be in the conditions of all those roles. We can all do that, and we can all share that point of view. Yeah.
Yes. Earlier, an example was used of a woman who's is it amygdala?
Amygdala,
Was severed, not working, and she had no rational fears. We wonder if she also had no irrational fears, but we don't know that or not. But
she had no fear.
No fear at all.
None.
Rational
under any,
or irrational.
No, no fear at all.
Okay. Well, it's interesting, though, that the most highly developed and purified brain would be that of an elder brother or master, and they have no irrational fears. They work the intuition or the common sense, which is for the common good of all, is functioning so that they know how to act in all situations. They know how, and they have no fear of the consequences because they know what to do and how to do it.
Whether you view it as the Christ, the Buddha, the Krishna, you know, the masters that come to all nations and peoples at various times, or whether you're coming to this analysis from the scientific and you're thinking about Maslow's self-actualizing adult, in all cases what has happened is there's a process through which experience, wisdom, the discipline of effort has been honed and concentrated, so there that self-confidence is, I am eternal, I am not this body, I am not this personality, and I observe the circumstances, I can look into the circumstances and understand them, but I can move beyond that and continue to act and serve and commit. And again, it's a matter of degree, isn't it? We can see a difference in the self-confidence of a toddler, the self-confidence of a 30-year-old, the self-confidence of a 60-year-old, and the self-confidence of a 90-year-old. It's all a matter of degree, and that's only in a particular lifetime. But we've got plenty of examples that we can look into historical accounts, prehistorical or legendary accounts, and find explanations. One of the things that was so much fun to look into was that I'd always heard about Doubting Thomas as one of the apostles, and recalled the story of the Christ saying to Doubting Peter, "Come on out of the boat and let's cross the water together, O ye of little faith." And again, I'm paraphrasing. But what I never knew culturally was that there is an account of the Buddha saying to a person named Sariputta that you are a man of faith to overcome sorrow and casting off all shackles. And it's the same story. It's a story of Sariputta being trapped on one side of the water and needing to walk on the water or wade through the water and move across the waters to the other side. And the Buddha is saying, have faith, have confidence, you can overcome and you can do this these things. I also found a quote from Tingley, from Catherine Tingley, which is kind of interesting. The devil we have to fear is the devil within ourselves, the animal or undeveloped aspect of our nature. The mortal part, resisting the Christos nature of ever-progressing spirit. It's a very interesting observation, and we are just about past time. So, these are certainly thoughts to consider, and you're welcome to come in and use the reference library. There are many, many, many sources with which you can explore this topic or many others. But give it a shot. Think about it a little bit. And you'll find in a variety of scriptural places hidden hints on how to deal with fear. The 23rd Psalm is something that you could consider if you want. There are incredible amounts of quotes that are available from a variety of philosophical and religious points of view that are available from the Dhammapada straight through to the New Testament, the Old Testament. No matter where you look, there is ancient advice reflecting theosophy on the subject of fear and doubt. Have a great week.